I think so. Does that work?
Yeah.
Good evening, everybody. My name is Kenny, and I am an alcoholic.
Hi.
And welcome to the retreat here. I want to thank Tom and Juanita for being my host here and showing me around town and for being our special, just being really special friends. And I want to thank Audrey for making the call and asking me to come do this retreat and for everybody that's here. So before we get started, I think we'd like to maybe just start with a simple... I wrote a prayer up here on the board, which I will explain. You're welcome to read that if you can, and I will kind of go over what that prayer means here in just a little bit. But first, we'll just start with something simple. So we'll start with the Serenity Prayer, and we'll get our weekend started. God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. So, I am just really incredibly grateful to be here in New Mexico, to be here at this retreat center, and to be here with y'all, and I'm really looking forward to getting to know a lot of the people here in the group, and as we kind of build here this weekend, we'll see how the format works. Maybe we'll get things in a circle and get things a little more comfortable. I'll take care of just a couple of things, letting you know who I am. I am an alcoholic. My sobriety date is June the 8th of 1989, and I've been continuously sober since that date. And my home group is Drunks Are Us North, which meets in Seattle, Washington on Friday nights at 8 o'clock. So if you are ever in Seattle, we really encourage you to come to our meeting. It's really it's quite a show on Friday nights there. And we actually, once in a while, we have to have an AA meeting and get a strong solution in the midst of all this craziness. So we'd hope that you'll come out to Seattle and visit us sometime and allow me to repay this favor. So I think I'm going to start tonight by just kind of telling you a little bit about my story, and we're just start with some real light stuff and some humorous stuff, and just kind of keep it simple. I'll tell you a little bit that you know, it's amazing to me to get asked to come do these retreats. It's amazing to me to be asked to come speak places, because there was definitely a time in my life and in my sobriety where nobody asked me to speak anywhere. I mean, it just was, because my story was kind of like what happened. And it was just this long, drawn-out thing, and then I would be like, and then I was in treatment, people would be thinking, oh, thank God, this guy's going to get sober, and then I drank the day I got out, and it was real heartwarming, actually, for me, and we'll look at that this weekend. We're really going to spend a lot of time in the book, and I just want to say, before I even get started, that I had that I do have this what happened part of my story today. And that's what I've really come here to New Mexico to share with you, is I came to share with you that I've had an experience with the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous that has allowed me to live for 17 years as a free man, much like anybody else lives, and to enjoy this great life and this somewhere in that process, this desire to destroy myself with alcohol and drugs was removed, and it was replaced by this useful and purposeful life, and I get to do a lot of really amazing things today, and I've got some really incredible stuff to share this weekend, and I hope that you'll my hope is that somebody's heart's going to be touched here this weekend by what I've come here to offer, that something I say is going to benefit somebody, is going to have, that there'll be some spiritual awakenings here this weekend. And I said I wouldn't really talk too much about this prayer yet, and I won't, but, you know, we're here to have a retreat. And you don't have to spend the weekend here to have a retreat. You know, just to come as much as you can this weekend. The 12 steps is really a spiritual treatment, and one of the things that we, you know, in Alcoholics Anonymous, we treat alcoholism with the 12 steps. That is the treatment, And so you can look at a retreat as, you know, if you've already had the treatment, and you may find, like I do, that the ego tends to kind of rebuild itself over a period of time. And suddenly I may be acting in a way in my life that seems kind of untreated, that I can come to a retreat and get retreated. And it's really something that came to me when I thought about this. I wrote this prayer that's up here, and I'll talk a little bit about that this weekend, about writing prayers. We're all going to have a chance to write prayers here this weekend and do some writing. And nothing I say here, don't let that scare you away. Nothing I say, there's nothing mandatory here this weekend at all in the least. And I really mean that. You know, that this idea of prayer and meditation, we'll do some meditation this weekend, this kind of stuff, it can't be forced. You know, it's just one of those things that has to come from within. So if there's anything that's said here or suggested here this weekend that doesn't sound right to you, then just don't do it, and nobody's going to be offended. And I want everybody to be comfortable. That's one of the things I said, like, about the circle and stuff, is it's a more comfortable setting, and I want everybody to be comfortable. Tom and Juanita have come out and done the retreat that we do in Seattle, and it's very comfortable. I mean, people actually, like, drag blankets and pillows, and people are in pajamas and stuff. I mean, it's a really comfortable retreat. Mike's been to a retreat that I did up in Durango a few years ago, and that was the same way. It was a small group, and we just, you know, we got to, allowed us to get really intimate with each other. So I hope that everybody, as the weekend, will start to kind of form a retreat family here and a circle even if we stay in this format, that people kind of start coming in a little bit and just be a part of this retreat. And it will be interactive, too. We're going to have a time between each sessions for questions and answers. I got into these retreats in really early sobriety, and I really thank God for that now. And you'll hear a lot of that as I tell my sobriety story about, you know, I just really feel fortunate today when I look back on it and I think about the guys that I got sober with, that I got sober at the time that I got sober. I was sharing with Audrey at dinner tonight about the World Convention in 1990 in Seattle, and I would have never went to that had it been anywhere else but Seattle. But I was happened to be sober in Seattle just coming up on a year, and had a really dramatic impact on me, and I met some really incredible people there. So I'm just glad I got sober when I got sober, and I'm glad I got sober with the people that I got sober with, and I'm glad that I ran into these people. And they were really big on this work in the big book, and they were really big on the work, the step work, and these guys were really big on retreats. And I've come to find that I don't think, certainly, there's never been a time in my entire sobriety that's been more than a year, and I would guess it must be less than that, somewhat less than a year, that I haven't personally taken the time to do a retreat. And, you know, these are incredibly important things in living the spiritual life. People that live spiritual lives retreat on a regular basis. So I'm really happy that we're here. So I'll tell you a little bit about my drinking history, and I will say this, that you know, this is a retreat. It's not an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting. But I will say this just to say it, because I like to say this, that I am an alcoholic member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And what that means is that if I was to take all of the drugs and everything out of my story completely, as if they never happened, and I just looked at my drinking, it would be abundantly clear to me. As a matter of fact, I've done that. You know, I've been through the big book from that standpoint, and it was abundantly clear to me that I am an alcoholic. So there is a lot of drugs in my story. There's a lot of talk about drugs, and I don't apologize for talking about drugs in AA. I'm beyond that, but I do let people know that, you know, and the reason I don't apologize for that is because I would be incomplete to come here this weekend and try to dance around that, and I've tried that before, and it doesn't work very good for me. So that is whatever it is. So you will hear my story. And in case you're ever wondering, I hope I get that point across that I drank a lot of booze, and I drank for a long time. And it was in there in the beginning, it was in the end, and it was in the middle. You know, the booze was one of those things that was always there for me, and it was always my fallback on deal. So with that, I'll just tell you a little bit about my story, and then we're going to take a break, and then we're going to come back, and we're going to get into some really serious retreat stuff. But we are going to have a great time here this weekend. We're going to have a fun time, and we're going to have, we might have an emotional time, but we're going to do our best to have some laughter here this weekend. You know, the laughter is one of the best medicines. We're going to try to be humorous and lighthearted, but we are going to also look at some really serious, serious stuff, and we're going to, we're not going to hide here this weekend either. We're going to really be, it's going to be a very direct from the big book weekend. It's the only thing that I really know. So with that, I'll go all the way back to the first time that I ever got really drunk, and there's a reason that I go back that far, and actually shortens my story a little bit, going back. And that is that the first time that I ever drank, I drank several times, but this was the first time that I drank with the sole purpose of just getting hammered. You know, I was just going to go out and get really, really drunk. And I came from an alcoholic home. My mother was an alcoholic. She got sober when I was 13 years old. Shortly after I started drinking, my mother got sober. She's still sober today. She got sober in AA. My stepfather, who I grew up with, died of alcoholism, drank himself to death, and he was homeless when he died. My house was the party house. They would go to the bar, and at 2 o'clock in the morning, when the bars closed in Washington State, the bar would come to my house, and that was just a normal deal for me. I mean, it was just this huge party, and there was myself and my brother and actually a sister who was 8 years younger, who was just a toddler at the time that I started drinking, that were all in this totally insane situation. And the police came a lot, and there was arrests, and there was domestic violence. And it was just a really sad situation. And one of the things that was going on in the house at that time leading up to this first time that I just made a decision that I needed a drink was that I wasn't really taught like the hygiene and how to really take care of yourself. And it just wasn't, there just wasn't a lot of parenting in the house. You know, there was food and there was a roof over our head, but there wasn't a lot of real parenting. So I would get up and I would get myself off to school every morning. And we just moved to another new neighborhood, which was just one after the other, because we were renting houses and get kicked out of houses. And we got to a new neighborhood, and I went to this brand new junior high school. And I think when I started junior high, I was 12. I turned 13 shortly after that. And I was still wet in the bed. And I would get up and I would just kind of like, and I have got over that problem, in case you guys you don't need to check your sheets, Tom, at the bed. I did fine last night. I did get over that shortly after I got sober. But I was still wet in the bed. And I would just kind of get up and I would just kind of towel dry myself off and throw some clothes and try to find some clothes in the basket somewhere and just put these dirty clothes back on. And I wouldn't brush my teeth, and I was going to school like I was scared to death in school like that. And then I had another thing, and I don't really like that word drug of choice, because really I think it's most more of a drug of no choice was the way it ended up for me. But just because the term kind of fits in this situation, my first drug of choice was called lack of oxygen to the brain. And what that meant was that I would actually choke myself, and then just before I was going to completely pass out, and if you're nodding your head, this means you're a sick person. I would choke myself, and just before I was going to pass out, I would let go just a second before, and I would get this euphoria for like 30 seconds or a minute, just be completely out of it. So I was a stinky kid with bad breath, and I smelled like urine. I was wearing, old clothes, coming to a brand new school where I didn't know anybody. And then I would choke myself and stagger around and stuff. So in junior high, my popularity kind of waned a little bit. I tell that because it is kind of humorous looking back on it, and I just, and people really thought this kid is a freak. And I used to hear that a lot, like, you are a freak, and no, don't come around me. Don't let that kid touch you. And it was just a horrible deal. And the reason I tell you that, you don't need that kind of background to become an alcoholic. I do know that. My wife and I spoke at a deal just a little while ago, and there was two other speakers there, and they both came from these beautiful houses where the parents went to church and went to church every day, and they were wealthy and they were well cared for, and they were They became just as hopeless as I did. So I don't want you to take this wrong. But something I've really thought about is, coming from where I came from, there was something rather soothing about a drink. And it did something for me that I don't know that it would have done for a lot of other people. And my brother and I mowed this guy's yard, and he was a hippie that lived next door. And you know, we thought, well, he's pretty cool. You know, he's a hippie, and we knew he drank and smoked dope and stuff. And so we thought, well, maybe instead of paying us, he'll just buy us some wine. So we thought, well, okay. So we asked him if he'd mind buying some wine instead of paying us. And of course, being a good hippie, and this is the early 70s, and being a good hippie, he had no problem buying wine for 12-year-olds. And so he was like, sure, you know, I'd be glad to buy you guys some booze. What do you want? And I didn't, the only thing I knew was my parents drank Gallo wine out of the gallon jugs. And so I said, well, wine. And he said, well, what kind of wine? And that there was that alcoholic thinking that never went away. And I just told him, and I had an older brother, and I was doing the talking. And I told him, I said, well, we're not really concerned with the volume. You know, we're not so concerned about the type. We're more concerned about the amount, the volume here. Just get us the most you can for that price, you know. So he said, okay, and he came back and he had 5/5 of MD 2020. And I love to tell that story because that's the reaction I always get. You know, I could just end that story right there because everybody knows where that story's headed. But that night, you know, that guy who like would never, and I couldn't talk to anybody, I couldn't do anything, and we got that wine, and we told a couple other kids that were in our neighborhood that we had the wine, and we're going down to the schoolyard tonight. And a couple other kids joined us, and even these kids that knew nothing about drinking were telling me, I don't know for sure, but I don't think you're supposed to drink that much that fast. You know, I think that something bad is going to happen to you if you do that. And I just was drinking this wine, drank as much as I could, as fast as I could. And there was a girl that was coming home. She was like just cutting across the schoolyard at night. And she was a girl that I'd seen at the junior high school. And I thought, you know, I thought to myself, you know, with this, once I had that wine in me, that kid that I was just completely transformed. And I thought, I'm just going to go down and take what's rightfully mine, you know. And I ran down this hill and I tackled this poor girl to the ground and I tried to force her to give me a kiss. And I, you know, I was just telling her, oh, come on, give me a kiss. And she was screaming and she got away and the other guys are, what the hell are you doing? And it was just really a scene. And the thing about that, you know, I was already that kind of that freak kid at school. And then, you know, immediately I knew about that horror and remorsefulness of the next morning are unforgettable, that I knew I had to go back to the school being this freak who had now attacked this girl at the school the night before. You know, and then, you know, that makes for more drinking and that stuff. It just kind of started. And the reason I say that kind of shortens my story a little bit because I can leave a lot of my drinking out and a lot of my drugging out because my drinking and drugging never got any better than that. That was as good as it ever got for me. I would drink as much as I could. I would drink as fast as I could. And usually I would do something completely over the top. I would get in a fight. I would commit a crime. I would try to fight police officers. I would hit women. I would wreck cars. I was in the hospital, and I never finished junior high school. I was in the juvenile system immediately. I was within about 3 months of that first drink. I was taken out of my home. I was arrested for burglary within a year of that time. I was a homeless kid on the streets shortly after that because they would put me in these group homes and foster homes, and I would run away and go back to the old neighborhood, and I was breaking and doing auto thefts and stealing cars and getting arrested, and that just kind of continued through when I was about 17 or 18. I kind of got my act together for a few years, and I got my grandpa worked, and he had some fishing boats that he worked for a family that owned some fishing boats, and they were going up to Alaska, and he got me a job, and it kind of saved me in a way because this was a job where you could, you know, somehow I just had this really great work ethic, and I was able to work really hard, and I kind of somehow got my act together for a few years, and it was a job back then, and the Alaska fishing industry is a lot different now, but back then you could drink and drug on board the boat. I mean, it was all kind of a part of the thing. It was just everybody kind of thought this is the wild, wild west, and there's no police out here, and there's nobody watching what was going on. And a whole bunch of guys, you know, hurt themselves and got killed in the Coast Guard. You know, now you have to have, man, everybody on the boat has to take a drug test before you can even throw the lines and leave the dock nowadays. And I still work in that business. I don't work going on the boats. I work in management in that business now. So it was something I came back to after I was sober. But, you know, as a teenager, I got introduced to IV drugs, and I was doing IV drugs from a very early age. And that started a heroin addiction that was kind of an on-again, off-again thing all the way up to the time I got sober. And I went through this success in my business, and I actually worked my way up from a deckhand to an assistant engineer, and then I was chief engineer on the boat. And then the family that I worked for put me through treatment twice and finally let me go. And I couldn't even get sober enough to do that job. You know, in the end, I couldn't get well enough to even take a job where you can drink and drug on the job. I was, and so you know, I spent the last several years of my drinking and drugging in and out of hospitals, in and out of treatment centers. I'd accumulated some stuff during those years, and I sold all of it down to the very last little thing. Sold everything that I could get my hands on. I sold a lot of stuff that didn't belong to me. And you know, there came a time I was just kind of existing, just living in these motel rooms and living in these motel rooms. This is a story I was reminded of last night. We were sitting around at Tom Juanita's, and we were telling kind of some humorous stories, and people were talking about falling asleep with cigarettes, you know, how dangerous that is. And I used to actually think life wasn't quite treating me well when I would, because I would go buy a whole pack of cigarettes, and I would sit down there in one of those hotel rooms, and I would light up a smoke, and I would think, I'm going to sit here and enjoy this whole cigarette. And I'd take one drag, and then out I'd go. And then I'd wake up and be burning my hand, you know. And I'd just be thinking, God, is that too much to ask to just be able to sit here and smoke a cigarette, you know, for Christ's sake. I'd go through a whole pack, and I don't even, you know, I'm in nicotine withdrawals here. And I've just, you know, I've just went through a whole pack. But I was in a hotel room. In Seattle, and it was called the City Center Motel, and it's gone now, but a lot of people still remember it. And it was one of those places that was full of prostitutes and drug addicts and people that were either coming to or going to the penitentiary. And there was I, and I fell asleep with a cigarette in that motel and started the mattress on fire. And I was laying there, and I was just in a pair of Levi's, no shirt, no socks, nothing, just in a pair of Levi's, and I was emaciated, and my eyes were sunk into the back of my head, and I had tracks all over my arms and hands and feet, and I was just in terrible shape, and laying there, passed out on this mattress that's smoldering. And for anybody that's, and I know there's several, but for anybody that's dealt with a mattress fire, they're really incredibly difficult things to put out. And I actually ended up, later on in life, I sponsored a fireman, and he said, oh yeah, you know, when we get mattress fires or couch fires, they just take them completely out of the house, and they just slice them open, and they just, you know, there's no way to get them out without just completely destroying them. So I got woke up because the smoke was so thick, I was choking on the smoke in this hotel room, and I woke up, and I thought, oh boy, I got a situation on my hands here. And I thought, well, I'm going to have to take some water, and I'm going to pour the water on this deal and put this fire out. And so I like got a pitcher, and I poured some water on this thing, and then I passed back out on this wet bed, and it started smoldering again, because that's not the way to put out a mattress fire. Started smoldering again, and the smoke got thick enough again to where I was choking on the smoke, and thank God I woke up. I mean, I would have killed myself and probably a whole bunch of other dope fiends too that would have never woke up in time had I burned that place down. But I woke up, and then I thought, okay, I got to get serious here. So I took one of the trash cans. They had a nice big trash can, and I took it in and started filling it in the shower and dumping that thing on the mattress, and then I passed out on the mattress again. And then I finally woke up, and I was choking again, and the smoke had got down in the mattress somewhere, and it was burning again, and there's all this water everywhere. And the thing about that is that a couple nights before that, I'd gone on a little paranoid trip, and I figured I needed to get the carpet up because there was something under the carpet that needed to be investigated. And I tore, and I tore all of the carpet up from this place. I like tore all the carpet up, and then in a moment of clarity, I tried to put all the carpet back and tried to put the molding strips back, you know, to where they were. But with all this water, the carpet's kind of floating a little bit. And this room is destroyed. And I had to take, I took a knife out of a pack I had. And I cut this mattress all up and finally, you know, tore the stuffing out of it and got this thing out. And the smoke was so thick, I had to open the front door to this motel room. And it was one of those old-style motels where you actually pull your car up and your bumper is practically touching the front window. And Highway 99 in Seattle goes right by where that city center, now it's a Holiday Inn Express. And this is right down close to where the Space Needle is, which in those days was really not a very good neighborhood at all. And now it's been all cleaned up and all the old haunts have been tore down. But at that time, the city center motel, so people were starting to drive rush hour to work. And the door was open, and I was passed out in that condition on this mattress, and there was stuff all over and water everywhere. And somebody, of course, alerted the manager that, hey, you might want to take a look in room number, 108 down there, and we think you got something going on. And he got up and started yelling and screaming at me, and I was yelling and screaming back at him, in the way that we do, that indignant alcoholic, just telling him that if he had a smoke detector in that room, which I reminded him by law, he should have. And none of this would have ever happened, and how this was his fault, that I could have been killed. And thank God I got the fire out in time. And I'm arguing with this guy, and I'm still just standing in just a pair of soaking wet Levi's, and that was it in that condition. And there was a guy, and he's actually 10 years sober in the program. I hope I get a chance to tell you the story about the amends I made to him. In case I forget, I made an amends with this guy years later, and he ended up, when I got to the what can I do to make it right part, he wanted to know what the hell I was doing to stay clean and sober. And he's been sober over 10 years in the program now. He was another addict, an alcoholic, but he was a guy that still had a job and still had a little bit of stuff going, so he had a girlfriend he was staying with and a car. So his job had become stopping by the motel room every morning on his way to work to see if I was still alive or not. And that was really it. It was a knock at the door. It was, and this is from another heroin addict, knocking on my door saying, are you okay? Is everything all right? I'm worried about you. I'd like to see you, maybe get into detox or something. He was, worried that he was going to, and so that was his deal, was coming by every morning. And Yogi came by that morning and saw this scene outside the deal and pulled his car right up and just got all my stuff and just threw it in the car and said, get in the car, we're out of here. And we got into the car. And the amazing thing about that story is I continued to drink and drug in that condition for maybe somewhat more than another year. I remained in that kind of condition. And the thing about that is that I got into amends and I remembered about that hotel room. And I can stand here and tell that story in good conscience because I went back and found the owner of that hotel who'd sold the building by that time, and I found the owner of the hotel and I explained the situation and I paid for the damage that I'd done to that hotel room. So I can tell that story in good conscience today. But, the thing about that was is that when I look back on it, I got into this amends process and then I remembered, oh yeah, I burned that guy's mattress up and stuff. But the thing about it was, is in that context of that day, there was nothing unusual in my life about that. I didn't call anybody up, tell them, God, you wouldn't believe what happened to me last night. Like it was a big, it was nothing. It was nothing to me. It was just, I was just existing in this hopeless state of mind and body, just existing. And there's a place in the book, big book, where it says, that we were living only, that we were existing only to drink. The only reason, the days of drinking and drugging for fun or for camaraderie or laughter or that feeling that life is good, all that stuff was completely gone. And the only reason I was drinking and the only reason I was drugging was trying my hardest to overcome this compulsion for more. That was it. It was, I just had this insane idea that if I could get enough in, this not that I would even feel good, but just that this compulsion for more would go away for a second or two. And I could just get a deep breath for a second. I was just at that place. And I existed like that for quite a while. I ended up getting hepatitis real bad and got really sick and ended up in a situation at my mom's house, which hopefully I'll be able to share a little bit about that. But it was a horrible deal, horrible thing. I was 28 years old and called my mom, and she had to tell me, no, you can't come home because of the damage I'd done to the family. And I told her, no, Mom, you don't understand. I am sick. I have to come home. And she thought I was coming home to die. And she told me that. You know, she thought that, my mother thought that, my mother is poor, and she's still poor to this day. And she's been gifted in that way, really. I mean, my mom just kind of doesn't care about money, and it's been a real good thing. She's been able to be of service in the lives of a lot of people because of that. But she started saving for my funeral when I came home. She didn't think I was going to make it. I was that sick. And I ended up getting a little bit better, and, you know, in front of, you know, there with my mom watching, I continued. Every time I got a little bit better, I would hit the bar and drink, and then the hepatitis would get really bad, and then I would be sick at her house for another 3 or 4 days, and then I would somehow con her boyfriend, or somebody would somehow, I would con my way into $20 or $30, and I would be gone again, and the whole time I was telling her I was clean. It was just a horrible situation, and I, you know, I put that woman through hell, and I've made amends for that as well, and I'll share some of the amends with my mom when we get to amends, and we should be getting to amends probably Saturday night sometime. In the end for me, my last drink, I went to a place called the Buckaroo Tavern. And the Buckaroo Tavern was a lot like that hotel I described. It was those same group of people that would drink at the Buckaroo Tavern. And it's the same way now. Sometimes I'll tell that story and somebody will rip, and they'll say, oh, that Buckaroo, that's a yuppie joint. And Tom and I had that experience. He showed me this place where he used to drink, but he said, but it didn't used to be like that. Because I said, well, that's a pretty nice place to drink. No, it wasn't then, you know. And So some people said, oh, yeah, the Buckaroo, that's kind of a yuppie joint now, but it wasn't then. And I was down to my last few dollars, and I had like maybe $3 to my name, and I didn't have enough money to re-up at the hotel I was at, so I packed my stuff with me, left that hotel room. I thought, well, I'll go to the Buckaroo Tavern. This is in the morning. They were just opening. I'll go to the Buckaroo Tavern, and I'll get a pint of beer, and somebody will show up. It's going to, you know, somebody will show up, and there'll be somebody that maybe owes me a little favor. Like, I can remind them, like, hey, remember when I was in the fat city, you know, remember, I took care of you, buddy. And I was kind of hoping somebody like that would show up, or somebody would show up and just kind of maybe buy me a drink. So I knew that was my only beer, and I couldn't drink it too fast, because as soon as I wasn't buying, they were going to kick me out. And I was in that kind of shape that even in the Buckaroo Tavern, you know, they had their eye on me. They were like, okay, we'll give you a beer. Sit over there and be quiet, and we'll give you a beer. And I was drinking my beer, and I got about halfway through my beer, and it started coming back up. And I ran out the door of the Buckaroo Tavern. I threw up on my way out, and that was my last drink. And I didn't get sober that day. That was my last drink. I continued to use for another day or 2 days, and I kind of lost track of time. And I really don't have a good recollection of the next several days. But I ended up behind a McDonald's in Seattle, and there's two buildings. There's a Viking bar that's called Hagar's, which means, you know, Norwegians and Swedes drink in there. There's this Viking bar named Hagar's, and then next door to that is the McDonald's. And in between, there's like this facade. So from the front, if you walked by, you'd think it was all connected, one building. But if you go around behind in the parking lot, there's a space between that building that you can get in. And I'd found that space somehow, and I'd also been over behind a store digging around. I found this big, huge piece of cardboard, and I'd kind of made a piece of cardboard lean thing between there so people couldn't see in. And I sat there and just kind of existed, and I was shooting speedballs. And I was telling Tom today that, and we'll talk about this more when I get to amends, that, you know, I don't have any idea to this day where I got the money for that, because my memory was spending my last few dollars at the Buckaroo Tavern. And as I threw up, I got desperate, and I did something. I don't know what. But I had money, and I had drugs, and I sat there for a couple of days until, of course, I was out of money and drugs again behind that McDonald's. And I could look out from that McDonald's. If I went out, I could look across. There was a big open parking lot, and there was an AA hall there. And the people from the AA hall would come out the back of the AA hall. This is actually the big back porch on this hall. It was called Fremont Hall in Seattle. And there was a big porch back there. And I could see the AA people there. And I'd been in and out and in and out of AA. I was in my first treatment center when I was 17, and I was on about number 5 at this time. And those are ones I finished. You know, I checked into a lot of detoxes and stuff, and then when the fever was on, I was would jet, you know, within 24 hours. I could see that AA hall, but then I just would go back and I'd sit there, and I could hear the drive-through too at the McDonald's. That was the thing that really freaked me out. I could hear the drive-through, and I could hear him say, "Yeah, I'll have a number 3 supersize with a Diet Coke." And then I'd think, "Oh my God!" And I think what they said was, "Hey, there's a freak back there shooting coke. Somebody." And then I'd hear the next guy pull up, and I think they were saying, "Call the FBI." And I'm thinking, "Oh my God!" You know, you know, I've since found out that the FBI doesn't have a huge budget for those kind of, you know, behind McDonald's guys. But I was convinced, you know, that the federal government was involved somehow with my not being sober. But I knew a guy that I'd actually lived with as a kid. His family lived in the same neighborhood as where I started drinking. And I ended up at a time in my life, I ended up living, his family took me in, and I lived with his family for a period of time. So this guy was like a brother to me. And he was going to AA at that time, and he was going to that hall. And I knew it. I knew that he would be there if I would just go. And I knew the meetings were about 8 o'clock, and I kind of, well, what the hell else am I going to do? I'll go to that meeting. My friend Donner will be there. And he and his girlfriend, now it's his wife now, but it was his girlfriend at that time, they'll take me in, and they'll nurse me back to health on their couch like they'd done many times. And you know, I had no intention of getting sober. I had no intention of wanting to be sober. I had no intention of trying to get sober. It just wasn't there. I mean, I wasn't even a want-to guy. I was just a guy, I was just in so much fear of what would happen if I actually, you know, had to get sober, of what that would be like. And my experience was always, you know, that I would get sober for a period of time, and that deal we'll talk about, we're going to talk about that tonight when we come back in after the break, that restless, irritable, and discontent deal would happen. And I would get to a place where I was actually paralyzed with fear sober. And I would get to a place where I had to drink. Where I had to drink. It was either drink or kill myself. I mean, that was that would be what it would feel like for me to be sober. So I didn't want to get sober, but I just thought maybe I did need to kind of go through the withdrawals and get my habit down to a reasonable amount and nurse myself back to health and all those kind of things. And I went to that AA meeting and took a seat, and this guy that I was looking for didn't show up. And I was sitting in the meeting, and I just started crying, like alligator tears. And it was a silent deal, too, you know. I mean, I wasn't bawling, but I just had these tears, just, and I couldn't stop it. I didn't try to wipe my face. And I just didn't know what the hell I was going to do. I was thinking, well, I could rob a bank when the bank's open in the morning. That was really what I was thinking. You know, I was thinking I could rob a bank. That would do it. That would give me a couple thousand bucks. That would maybe last a day or two. And I caused a little bit of a scene. Some people said some things, and I was, you know, real dramatic. The junkie pride deal is really a dramatic condition. And I'm so hardcore, that kind of stuff. And you don't know what I've been through, you know, and I've been shooting dope since I was a teenager. I really was kind of out of gas. And this guy came up, and I like to say this, that I learned about giving from an absolute expert, and he's a guy that I still spend time with today. I was just with him last week again, and he's over 30 years sober now. And he came up to me in that meeting and said, "Hey, my friends and I have been talking, and we'll make all the arrangements. If you want to go to detox, we'll give you a ride. We've already called down there, and they got a bed." And of course, I'm thinking, well, I've seen a couple things. I was thinking, one, about, you know, maybe I better check my social calendar and make sure I can fit this detox deal in. And the other thing I'm thinking is, how the hell does this guy know I need to go to detox? But it was that kind of a deal. I mean, they didn't ask, you know, what's your situation. Nobody asked, are you homeless? Nobody asked. It was just that. You know, they said, "Do you want to go to detox?" And I said, "Well, yeah, I would go." And they took me to a detox in the next city up from Seattle, which is Everett, in Snohomish County. And it's, I don't know what to compare it to here, but it's for, you know, when you're strung out like that and you're drinking with that circle of friends, you know, your world gets really small. And that was far enough removed from me to where I just didn't have the game to leave that detox and then panhandle the money and then try to get a couple buses all the way to Everett or all the way to Seattle and then try to find somebody to something to steal and then try to find somebody to you know, it just didn't have it in me. And so I got my first 5 days of sobriety at Evergreen Manor Detox in Everett, Washington. And that guy that drove me to the detox that night was there the night I got out. And he picked me up and he took me to his home. And then I could kind of hear his girlfriend saying, you know, he was like, stay out here in the front room. I'm going to go talk to my girlfriend for a little bit. And I heard her saying, well, are you crazy? Have you seen this guy? And, you know, what are you doing? And then, you know, no goddamn way, no way, no way. And then he'd come in, okay, it's going to be all right. You'll be able to stay here for the night, you know. And he let me stay there for the night. And this guy owned a car lot down on Highway 99. And it was the same area where I'd just been going through all that hotel stuff. And he owned a little car lot down there. And there was a little apartment that had been fixed up in the back of the car lot. And he took me down there the next day. And he said, well, listen, I'll let you stay here for a while. And there are some conditions. And you know, have to stay clean and sober. I have to go to the noon meeting, the 5 o'clock meeting, the 8 o'clock meeting. I'll give you a little work here at the car lot. The reason I say I learned about giving from an expert is that guy gave me a place to stay. And it's emotional for me even to talk about this even today, 17 years later, thinking about the size of that guy's heart. I didn't know this guy, never met him before in my life. He took me down to the car lot. He came by every morning for 6 months and bought me breakfast. Every morning for the first 6 months of my sobriety, Al would come, wake me up and say, hey, let's go up to the Jack in the Box. We'll get a breakfast Jack and a cup of coffee. He was the first man I ever prayed with in my entire life. First guy that ever said, well, have you tried prayer? Let's do a little prayer. You know, I'm so grateful to him and to his buddies. And he'd give me a few dollars, you know. Again, that alcoholic indignant deal. This was a guy. And now I've drove by. He doesn't own the car lot anymore. And I think part of the reason his business failed, and I think part of the reason his business failed is because he was giving all of his money to alcoholics. I really believe that. He was spending so much time on alcoholics, he wasn't really selling any cars. And, you know, all the AAs were dropping by the car lot because it was a place for a free cup of coffee. I mean, it was just like a little mini AA hall at his car lot. And once in a while, he sold a car. If a customer would really come in and really try very hard, he would sell him a car. But, you know, I drive by that car lot now and I look at it. It's a little tiny dirt lot. You know, there's no pavement or anything. It's just like a little patch of dirt. And you can put about 8 or 10 cars on there at a time. And he would pay me every day to go out and start them up and kind of get the batteries going. Or maybe that tire, we'll take those snow tires off that car and there's some other tires out in the ground. Put them on there and, you know, vacuum that car up, kind of clean it up and stuff. And at the time, this, you know, being the self-centered person that I was, I thought, well, I know what's going on here. What we got here is we got this guy who kind of preys on these people who are down on their luck in AA, and he cleans them up, and then he kind of gets them to work for these slave labor wages down on his car lot for $5 an hour. And I'm thinking, doesn't he know I was a chief engineer on a goddamn fishing boat and made a fortune, and he expects me to work down here for $5 an hour? And that was constantly going through my head. And the grateful thing now today, looking through the spiritual eye, which we get here in AA, looking through the spiritual eye, and I drive by that lot, and I see that he didn't need any help at all. You know, he was partners in that business with his brother. There was two of them. He didn't need any help at all. This was completely, there wasn't enough cars there to need a lot boy, you know. So it was completely from his heart. I would work there, and I'd get a few bucks in my pocket, and I'd try not my hardest not to get on the wrong side of a $20 bill. If I got about 15 bucks, I'd say, well, I think I'll stop working right there and head up to the hall. It was working great for me for a period of time, but you know, the anxiety built, and physically I was looking better. You know, I gained a little weight, and the lights were kind of back on in my eyes, and most of the people at the hall were kind of on to the next newcomer, and they weren't paying so much attention to me, And I started getting in this position where I started thinking, you know, the time and day is going to come for me. I'm going to drink again. I'd been through it so many times. And there was a group of guys that were kind of trolling the halls, and they called it that. You know, they called it trolling the bottom. And they would go by these halls late at night, 10 o'clock, midnight meeting, the low bottom hall. This Fremont Hall, they call it the emergency room of AA. And they actually have a sign on in there that says that, the emergency room of AA. And it's in a place in Highway 99 where there's probably about 75% of the people in the meetings at that hall are actually sober, and the rest are just street refuge people that are trying to get out in out of the cold, get a cup of coffee, and kind of hang out for a while, and then go back out. And so these guys would come by there, and they had this idea that their place in Alcoholics Anonymous, after having been through the steps, was to go to the meetings not to get anything, but to go to the meetings and look for the face of hopelessness and reach their hand out to the still suffering alcoholic as men who have a real answer. And that's what they did to me. These guys saw me there a few months sober, and I broke down in the meetings a few times and cried and said, you know, I'm just not getting it. And I was telling people, I'm going to drink again. I am going to drink again. I know it. I know I am going to drink again. And good, well-intentioned people in AA were coming up and saying, don't say that about yourself. That's not the way we do it around. Don't say that about yourself. But these guys said, yeah, you're damn right you will. Yeah. You know, without a real answer, you will die sitting in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. And we got an answer for guys like you. We're putting on a little workshop down at Fremont Baptist Church on Tuesday nights. And we're going to take people through the steps. And they also targeted my friend Patrick. And my friend Patrick, and I'll talk about him a little more this weekend too, but my friend Patrick was one day less sober than I. So I had one day more sobriety than Patrick. And Patrick was also sponsored by Al, the car lot guy, and Al was taking care of Patrick as well. And Patrick, for the most of the time, I'd been able to kind of come up with hotel rooms or people's couches to sleep on and stuff. But Patrick was really, truly right off of the skids. And he worked his way up and got sober, and Al was sponsoring him, and he'd got himself a little boarding room a few blocks from the car lot where he had a little room in a basement that he'd rented, and he had got himself a 10-speed bike. And you know, I was 28 at this time, almost 29, and Patrick was a few years older. It's hard to have your, you know, it's hard to have a lot of game, you know, down on Highway 99 when you're on your 10-speed, you know. It's like, but you still, you know, if you're alcoholic, you can still do it. You can still kind of have some. But you know, Patrick said, I'm going to go to that workshop, and he went down there. And he came back and said, oh, Kenny, he says, these guys are going to build a spiritual arch to which they're going to walk free, man. And I'm thinking in my mind, like, I'm thinking these guys are going to build this papier-mâché arch and that was going to be the deal here, was that these guys were going to build this. And I was thinking, that's never going to work. I've been down to the altar church call deal before, and that's never going to work, Patrick. But at the same time, I wasn't going to let Patrick. You know, I was one day sober more than him, so I was kind of showing him the ropes, and we had the same sponsor, and so I was thinking, well, I'm damned if I'm going to let him get a leg up in sobriety on me. So I started going to that workshop with Patrick, and we would go to the workshop, we'd listen to these guys, and then we would deprogram each other after the workshop. We'd stand around, we'd say, that guy's so full of crap. He's just saying all that fancy stuff to impress the girls, and I don't think he's even done that stuff himself. I think he might even be drinking. We had all kinds of theories, and these guys can't possibly be sober. But you know, then we'd say, okay, well, we'll see you back here next Tuesday, and next Tuesday we'd be back, and we started going through that workshop, and I started having that experience with the steps. I loved what they were talking about. It was this message that had depth and weight. It's the message that we're going to talk about and spend some time with this weekend. And it absolutely, completely, and totally revolutionized my whole entire attitude and outlook upon life, changed the way that I live. You know, I'm not the same person that I used to be. And there's a lot. I'll talk about the steps and stuff, but I'm going to do that in the course of as we kind of go through the steps this weekend. The thing about the that I will say is going through those steps, you know, something happened to me. I had this experience, this desire to destroy myself with drugs and alcohol, was removed somewhere along that way in that process, and I easily stay sober today, and you know, it's not really a part of my life. I live in that 10-step promise of the being in a position of neutrality, safe and protected. I live my life in that place today. You know, I've got a beautiful family today. I'll talk to you about my family. I got a daughter that's 15 years old that's never seen me take a drink. My wife and I adopted a teenager, brought a teenager into our house, a kid that needed a hand up, and I'll talk about him, brought him into my home. You know, it's just kind of been the holiday season, and this last Thanksgiving, my entire family was at my house for Thanksgiving this year. You know, my brother was there, my sister was there, my mom was there, my sister's two kids were there, my brother's girlfriend was there, my wife's sister was there. You know, the whole family was at my house. And I absolutely ruined a few Thanksgivings, you know, and I showed up at a Thanksgiving in the kind of shape I was like when I was in that hotel room. And I was thinking, I can't spend too much time in the bathroom. So I came up with this ingenious plan on a Thanksgiving day at my grandparents' house, where I had preloaded and taped a bunch of syringes to my legs. And I went to Thanksgiving dinner that way so that I could quickly just go in the bathroom and get a fix. And, you know, like every 15 minutes, oh, excuse me, I'll be right back. And I'd head for the bathroom. And, you know, it was destroying my family to watch what was going on. And it was a horrible situation. And I was sitting there, they were passing everything around and everybody was eating. And, of course, I didn't really feel like eating much, but I was sitting there, and I was just looking like I was getting ready to die right there at the table. And they said, well, what's wrong, Ken? How come you're not eating? And I said, well, I think I left my fork in one of the dishes that went around, and my fork was in my hand. And I said, and that was Thanksgiving. And then there were several, and that just kind of broke the whole thing down. You know, the whole family just kind of, you know, holy cow, Ken, what are you doing? You know, and do you have to be so out of it? And then there were several Thanksgivings that I didn't show up for. And the heartbreaking thing about those Thanksgivings is there wasn't one Thanksgiving that didn't go by that I didn't say I would be there. There was a lot of those Thanksgivings where I said I would be there, and I planned to be there, and I just couldn't get out of the house. And then I would stop answering the phone. And then I wouldn't talk to the family for weeks or months after that. And today, you know, I've got this family and all of those same people that were at Thanksgiving then came. And Tom and I were talking about this a little bit, you know, that my family saw me at my very worst condition. You know, they saw me a couple times in detoxes and when I was in horrible condition. And even now, 17 years later, when I say I need to go to a meeting, they are just like, oh, yeah, man, come on, you know, can we help you out? Is there anything we can do? They just think it's the greatest thing in the world. They just think that this is the greatest deal in the world. They don't ever question why I'm continuing to do this or why I do it to the level that I am, because they've seen this dramatic change happen. And we'll talk a little bit this weekend, too, about it's a little bit deep maybe for right now, but there is a connectedness. You know, we are all connected, and especially to our families. You know, we're connected. You know, if you don't have a family, you can come make AA your family. But we are connected. And my experience was that, and maybe there's a few Al-Anons in the room that might not agree with this, but I'll talk to Juanita about this after and see what she thinks. But you know, I have a belief that I made people sick, and I don't care what anybody says. You know, I know that I made my family sick, and I could do it today. If I was to go home from this retreat, start yelling at my kid and yelling at my wife and drinking it, my family would get sick. You know, I made those people sick. And that connectedness thing, my mom, and we'll talk about my mom a little bit more. My mom was sober quite a while when I was in those hotel rooms. She lived in Vancouver, Washington, which is about a 3-hour drive. She would get off work Friday night, and she would drive all the way up to Seattle and just drive up and down, up and down, up and down all of those cheesy hotels, hoping to see me. She had no idea, just hoping to see me. Just crazy, out of her mind. The thing about that is that for the most part, none of my family have been going to AA. None of my family have worked any steps. And you know what? When I see my family on Thanksgiving, they're better. I worked the steps, and they got better. Isn't that amazing? I mean, it's a really big deal we got here. I want to let everybody know that they can just really relax here this weekend. We're going to have a great weekend. You know, I've got some really neat stuff planned. I'll say it again for the people that came in towards the end. I'll kind of lay out a little bit. People, I think, like to kind of get a vision of where we're going. I do this with my sponsees when I'm sponsoring people. I don't ever just kind of hit them with something. I always kind of say, well, this is kind of how it's going to work. This is the timing we're on. This is what we're going to be looking at here in the next few weeks. And we'll take a break here in a few minutes. I think there's something a little funny about the smoking policy, so maybe somebody will make an announcement about that. But we'll take a break for people to smoke and use the restrooms. And I like to have a timekeeper at these retreats. It's helpful for me. So we'll turn the mic off here in a minute. But before we break up, we'll get a timekeeper to help us keep time. What that person does is just kind of go out and tell the people, okay, break's over, let's come back in and remind people of when the next session is and that kind of thing. We're going to come back in a little bit. And we're going to start cracking the book. We'll crack the book. I'm going to share some of my experience with you. We will have a time for questions and answers. I think I just kind of talked now, so I don't imagine there's a lot of questions yet. But we'll do a little first step deal. We'll have a time for questions and answers. We'll take another break. We'll just do. I think we're just going to do one more. What time is it? It's 8:00. We'll see what happens. We'll do one more session. We'll probably go till about 9:30 or 10:00 tonight. And then I think tomorrow morning we're going to start again at 9 o'clock, and we'll let everybody know what the schedule is from there. But my plan is, while I'm thinking about it, I'll tell you really a little bit about the retreat here is this, and that's that, I really have come to a place where I really believe that these retreats are not actually working the steps. I think we kind of drive ourselves a little crazy when we try to really get the full 12-step experience in a weekend. It's too much, too quick. So there's a deal on page 55 that caught my attention a few years ago. And I'm paraphrasing here a little bit. I would open it up, but I'm too lazy to walk over and open my book. It says that, if our testimony helps to sweep away prejudice, it encourages you to search diligently, to think honestly, to search diligently within yourself, then you can join us. And then it goes on to say, with this attitude, you cannot fail. And that's really what I think these weekends are about. I think these weekends are about a group of people coming together. And my purpose as the facilitator is try to accomplish that, try to encourage you to search diligently, to think honestly, to be open-minded. You know, they say some of these things, they actually say, with this attitude, you cannot fail. If we accomplish that in a weekend, there's people that will leave this retreat that will not fail. There's people that will leave this retreat and stay sober for life. I'm convinced of that. That first workshop that I went through, there was a big group of us that started. There was about a dozen of us that finished that workshop. And those workshops, we meet once a week for an hour and a half. And it'll take us about six to eight months to get all the way through the 12 steps in the workshops that I do. Those ones actually took a little longer. We were there probably there a year. But there was about 12 of us that finished. One of the gals actually died just last year, died of a drug overdose, and that left 11. And as far as I know, all of those other 11, myself included, Patrick was included, my first step sponsor, Jeffrey, was included. I could go on and name the rest of them. But, they're all still sober here 17 years later. There's a huge difference, and we'll see that. There's a huge difference. If you think you're in the solution because you're in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, you're not. Being in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous and being in the solution are two different things. These people, we came through the steps and we got in the solution, and we've stayed continuously sober as a group of people. And they're lifelong friends, these people. I mean, I see them and we light up every time we see each other. The idea of that too is that in our traditions, the third tradition says, the only requirement is a desire to stop drinking. That's the only requirement for membership in AA. But if you want to look at recovery from alcoholism, there's some requirements, and we're going to look at those this weekend. You know, if you really want to recover from alcoholism, have a spiritual awakening as a result of the steps, there's some requirements, and you don't have to do them. And also, I want to say this, too, that through this weekend, I am completely comfortable with people getting up and going and using the bathroom or taking a break, because we might have some sessions that will go a little long, and people get sore butts. And, you know, it's hard. Some people can, like, I'm a guy that I just go to these retreats myself, and I just sit and I just absorb it. I don't miss any sessions. I'll go to all of them. My wife will maybe go to some she's going to sleep, some she'll take, she'll go read a book, and she can't do the whole weekend. You know, I go to a convention and I'll try to do every step workshop, and she'll do maybe two, you know, so I completely understand if people get up and stretch and if we're talking or we're doing stuff. I just want people to know that's within the bounds. It's not, you know, it doesn't offend me in the least. It shouldn't disturb anybody. We should just really have kind of a open door policy. So if you feel like you're uncomfortable and you got to get up and leave for a minute, please do that. So we'll meet back here in 15 minutes. Don't go yet, but I'm going to turn off the mic here, and then we're going to elect a timekeeper and see if there isn't any other housekeeping announcements. Thanks for being very prompt with the 15-minute break. And one of our mentors used to say that the most important time at these retreats is the time in between the sessions when everybody's just standing around visiting. So we'll try to make sure that we get plenty of that this weekend, and that there's plenty of time for everybody to kind of process, because some of the stuff we're going to get to will be a little bit heavy. So each session, tomorrow I'll bring a chime. Each session we'll start a chime. I didn't bring it tonight. And then we'll have about a minute or two of just silent meditation before each session starts. And as we go through the weekend too, we're going to have some longer meditations that will be completely voluntary. There won't be anything mandatory about it. And I'll give you, it'll be the same thing. I'll try to really describe what we're going to do before we go there. So we'll find out if there's people that have never meditated before. We'll give some little instructions for meditation, but we'll try to realize a couple of things here that I'll say before I forget, and that is that a couple of statements of truth. And one of the statements of truth is that I love you. I love you because you saved my life. I love you because, you know, you've placed me in this position to be here with you this weekend, and you've shown up to listen to what I have to say, and it's very humbling for me to be in this position. I want to tell you another statement of fact, and that is that God is here, that we don't have to do anything to any amount of prayer or any amount of meditation or any amount of silence to bring about the presence of God, that is already been taken care of in advance for us. I want to say that this is a sacred place. And this is a sacred place because it's a sacred place for a lot of reasons. It's a sacred place because it's this nice retreat and convention center that I believe is owned by a Baptist church. Is that right? I should know where I'm at. Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. But, you know, as you travel around the country, you'll realize something. And when I'm talking about sacred space, that communities everywhere create these kind of spaces. There are retreat centers and places all over the country. And there's very rarely a town that doesn't have some kind of a center where people can kind of go to do spiritual work. And you know, we live in a society that really supports us. So it's a sacred place because it's been created for groups like us to get together and to come and to seek to know and do God's will in our lives. But even more than that, it's sacred because we have chosen this place. You know, it's sacred because we are here. Each individual person, you know, has brought a level to this place that makes it sacred. We've chosen this place and this weekend to bring some of our problems, some of the difficulties in our lives, some of those kind of things. We've chosen this weekend to bring those ideas or to retreat from those ideas and come here. So I just wanted to say that so I didn't forget. Just a couple of statements of fact so we can get a few things clear and out of the way as to what it is we're doing here. So with that, we're going to do just a minute or two of meditation, and we'll just keep it real short, maybe do just a 1 minute silent meditation, and I'm going to bring us out of that with this prayer that's on the board here. You don't need to follow along with that if you don't want to, or if you might not even be able to read it, but I'll bring us out of that with this retreat prayer that I've written up here, and then we'll talk about the retreat prayer and we'll go from there. God, as we retreat, as we withdraw from, all we see is hazardous, all we see is unpleasant, all we see is difficult. As we retreat from positions in our thinking, in our attitudes, in our knowledge, let us rest this weekend in this place of privacy, in this place of safety, in prayer, meditation, and study. Allow this retreat to deepen our awareness of life, our sense of humor, our love for everything and for all, and our desire to live the spiritual life. Amen. So, this retreat prayer, we talked a little bit in the last session about what retreat means. I know some few people came in, so we'll go over it a little bit. But retreat can mean a lot of things. It can mean, we talked about this 12 steps being a treatment for alcoholism. The 12 steps are specifically designed, our AA 12 steps are specifically designed to treat this human problem of alcoholism. And they do a great job of that. So they are a treatment. And some people have been through the steps and have experienced the same things that I've experienced, which is that, you know, having gone through the steps, I will have had this spiritual awakening. I'll be working with others. I'll be kind of living in 10, 11, and 12. And there seems to be kind of two schools of thought on this. And neither one is right or wrong. We're not really going to try to get into too much right or wrong issues here this weekend. And I'll tell you why, because you've asked an interesting guy to come and share for a whole weekend on AA, and the interesting thing about it is that I will come right out and tell you that I have been wrong about almost everything in my entire life. So you need to take what I have to say with a grain of salt. And you know, I will tell you that, and we'll talk about this more this weekend, but I was wrong about my mother. I was wrong about my father. I was wrong about my brother and my sister. I was wrong about my grandfather. I was wrong about Alcoholics Anonymous, and I was wrong about the 12 steps. And I was wrong about my employer. I was wrong about Al down at the car lot. I was wrong about N.A. I was wrong about I was wrong about God. I was wrong about a spiritual awakening. I was wrong about you all, in the, you know, kind of the big book AA people. That having been said, we're not going to, it's difficult for me to draw hard, fast lines of what's right and wrong, isn't it? When I come right out with what the truth is, which is that Kenny is a person that consistently in his life has had a difficulty looking at differentiating the truth from the false. So that's my deal. So I'm not saying there's a right or a wrong here. I'm just saying there is two schools of thought on this, and I'll tell you where I currently come from. This one school of thought is that we work the steps once, and then we live in 10, 11, and 12, and that is very good. my experience is that I live through these first nine steps, living in 10, 11, and 12. Eventually, the ego rebuilds itself, and I start once more being living in this place of restless, irritable, and discontent. And I have consistently found it necessary to retreat from these positions in my thinking, my attitudes, and my knowledge, the things that I think that I know. I've consistently needed to retreat from things in my life that are difficult, hazardous, unpleasant. And I've needed to kind of take a rest, and that's the retreat. You know, I went through that workshop that I talked about. That was the treatment. And I've had to come back and do these retreats. So that's part of it. It's also like a withdraw from. I happen to read a lot of spiritual material. One of the guys I really have kind of gone back to over and over because I really like his stuff, and I'm not making any endorsements here, and I won't do that at all this weekend to any particular brand of spirituality or anything. But one guy that I've come back to is a guy named Emmett Fox. And what Emmett Fox says is that the door to the soul opens inward. And what that means is you need to withdraw, to retreat, to get away for a weekend, you know, and just retreat. Say, hey, I'm an open-minded person. I'll go to this retreat. I'll do these things. And I will, the door to the soul opens inward. And if you looked at this door and that door, they open outwards because they have a law that says that door has to open outwards. I know that's why that door is that way. Because when people panic, what do? They push in the physical life. Well, in the spiritual life, it's just the opposite. You know, we retreat in the spiritual life. We withdraw. You got to relax. In the spiritual life, when you push and push and push and push, you're doing something, doing something, doing something, doing something, and it's just, you know, you're pushing, pushing. In the spiritual life, the door just closes tighter and tighter and tighter and tighter. It just makes it worse. So this is the idea here this weekend. I talked in the first session a little bit about my mother, and for some reason I just feel compelled. This is kind of the something that maybe I would normally do on a Sunday, but I just thought I'd just pull out the big guns right away. So just to give you an idea of where we're going, this session is going to be the time that we'll spend talking on the first step, and this is out of context a little bit. And my mind kind of works that way, so you'll notice that we'll move around here a little bit this weekend. But we will get through, and we will talk about each one of the steps to the best of our ability. I actually don't know how far we'll get. But I will tell you, this Sunday morning, we're going to talk about the 12th step. That's really why I came here, was for what I have to share with you on Sunday morning. So if you've got plans for Sunday morning and you can change them, try to be here. And if you can't, I'm happy that this is being taped, I guess. So, because I've got some really neat, amazing things to share with you about the 12-step work that's happened in my life. And just so we're clear about this, and like I told you, I like to let people know where we're going. I've done this retreat I've many times. I've been sponsored by several different people in my sobriety. I've found somebody that has what I want, and I will ask them to take me through the steps. I'm being sponsored by a guy right now that doesn't necessarily adhere to completely this big book deal, and that was really good for me because when he started sponsoring me, he said about in the first, maybe the second, first or second time we met, he said, Kenny, you know way too much about that big book. So we're going to go all the way through the steps, and we're not ever going to crack that big book. So next time you come, leave your big book at home. And it's been a wonderful experience for me. But just so you know where we're going here, that I've been through the steps with him in a lot of different ways and in retreats. I've listened to a lot of different people. I told Tom and Juanita about an experience that I had going and sitting through a deal where you actually work all 12 steps in one weekend, and it was really kind of an insane deal. But I went into it open-minded. It's not my deal. These retreats, we're not actually going to work all 12 steps because it's just. But we're going to get a vision of what your life would look like if you did work all 12 steps. You will have that when you leave here Sunday, if you put the time in. So, the point is that. And the reason we're going to get to where we're going on Sunday is this, that no matter how many times you work the steps, it always leads to the same place. And we forget about this. Sometimes we think that I'm going to work the steps and my problems are going to get better. I'm going to do this. The 12 steps, as designed, as near as I can tell, always lead to looking for the face of hopelessness and reaching your hand out to a still suffering alcoholic. That's really the whole deal here. You know, all of the rest of this work that we're going to do is in preparation for that. And, you know, one of the great mentors in AA and a guy that's gone now, but I heard a lot of people call him, you know, they called him one of the great AA sponsors. And he said that. He said, this isn't the work. This puts us in fit spiritual condition to do the work. And I just inherently know that to be true. That all of the 12-step work that I did wasn't, you know, I lived a pretty poor, selfish, self-centered way of life for a lot of years. And this spiritual experience that I've had, I believe, is meant for me, but it's not meant for me only. There's a much bigger picture here going on. And it's the same way with this retreat. This retreat is for the people who are here, but wouldn't it be sad if it was only for the people that are here? It is for the people who are here, but it's not for you only. The purpose of this retreat is that we come and we retreat, we go through the steps, and we are going to be people that leave this retreat with a real answer, and we're going to be people that go to meetings, not to try to get something out of the meeting, but go to the meeting looking to bring something to the party. I'm going to be a guy that goes to the meeting, and when I see the face of hopelessness, I'm going to go up and make an introduction, be a guy who makes the approach. And so that's really the bigger picture, is that, you know, my vision would be that this retreat will touch a whole lot of people that aren't even here this weekend. It doesn't really matter how many people come to this retreat. Tom and Juanita said, I don't know how many people will be at the retreat. Could be 20, could be a lot more. We don't know how many it could be. And it didn't matter, because I know what the real purpose is. You know, the book says you may be but one man with this book in your hand. You know, we started with just one guy with this idea that maybe if he helped another alcoholic, he could stay sober himself. So the fact that we've got this many people for this weekend is, you know, the ramifications are really quite huge. So I'm glad that we're here. I'm glad we've kind of established where we're going, that we will get to the 12th step by Sunday. And I told you I'd bring out the big guns right away, so I will, but because I talked about my mother in my talk here. I talked about the time that I spent down there, and, you know, I ended up leaving her house. And I wasn't sober, and that was before that deal with the McDonald's, and I think that motel deal had already happened, and I kind of ended up down at my mom's sometime in between that and the Buckaroo Tavern and existing behind the McDonald's. But I showed up at her house in just absolutely terrible condition at my mother's home, and she didn't want to let me in. I called her, and she said, no, you can't come, and I said, Mom, you know, I am, and she just heard it in my voice. I said, Mom, I'm sick. I need to come home. And she knew. She said, okay, come. And I came. I called my brother. He met me at a restaurant to kind of be the mediator. I actually had called my brother and asked if I could come to his house. And he said, no, I've got kids and I can't have you around, but I will meet you at a restaurant and just kind of hear you out. So he met me at a restaurant. And then he called my mom for me and said, well, listen, you know, Kenny does need a place to go. And I showed up at my mom's house. My brother Jeff had given me a ride. This is an email that I got from my mother. It's dated December 7th, 2005, which was 16 years after I showed up. And actually, I continued using, so it's probably about 17 years after I showed up at my mom's doorstep. My mom does a lot of spiritual work. She's a Reiki master. She's a real kind of a woo-woo earth mother, and we really love her in my family. But she does a lot of volunteer. She does this TIP thing, and what TIP is it's trauma intervention and prevention. And she goes to the scenes of horrific accidents, and she just has this peace